How significant a factor was Russia's involvement in World War I in the success of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917? How does one account for the efficiency and success of the worker uprisings during the year 1917? In what ways did the major capitalist countries, especially the United States, push back against the newly founded Soviet Union, and why? Did Stalin's vision of socialism in one country contribute to the success or the ultimate failure of the 20th century socialist project? How does the notion of a permanent counter-revolution contribute to our understanding of the failure of radical progressive movements over the last century? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we mark the centenary of the Russian Revolution. We'll present conversations with three analysts, Professor Jacques Powels, Professor Michel Chosudovsky, and Professor Case Vanderpyle, on the dynamics of the Russian Revolution and its legacy. On this week's program, The Russian Revolution at 100, The Legend and the Legacy. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 3rd, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Last week, the Air Force announced that it was preparing to put its B-52 nuclear bombers back on 24-hour alert. At the same time, as reported by The Guardian yesterday, the Trump administration is drawing up a new nuclear posture review, which will open the door for a range of new nuclear weapons and change the rules governing their use. The only conclusion that the North Korean regime can reach is that the country confronts the imminent threat of a U.S. military onslaught using conventional and/or nuclear weapons. The South Korean-based NKN News reported over the weekend that North Korea has been carrying out mass evacuation drills in cities and towns along the East Coast. The world may be closer to the brink of nuclear war than at any time in history. That comes from the article, U.S. Masses Ships and Aircraft Outside North Korea, by Peter Simmons, posted November 1st, originally appearing at World Socialist website. In the wake of the war on Iraq in 2003, the Bush administration officially identified Iran and Syria as the next stage of the roadmap to war. Bush's national security doctrine, contained in the Project for the New American Century, or PNAC, was a continuation of Clinton's strategy of containment of rogue states. The PNAC's declared objectives were defend the American homeland, fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars, perform the constabulary duties associated with shaping the security environment in critical regions, transform U.S. forces to exploit the revolution in military affairs. The PNAC did not elaborate on America's stated mandate to spread democracy through the conduct of humanitarian wars. Fight decisively and win major theater wars was part of America's long war. That was from an introduction to selected articles and essays from the Global Research Archives by Professor Michel Chosudovsky, posted November 1st under the headline, Iran, Next Target of U.S. Military Aggression in the Wake of the Invasion of Iraq, the 2005 Military Roadmap. U.S. military sources confirm that 20% of North Korea's population was killed off over a three-period of intensive bombings. Quote, after destroying North Korea's 78 cities and thousands of her villages and killing countless numbers of her civilians, General LeMay remarked, over a period of 3 years or so, we killed off, what, 20% of the population? It is now believed that the population north of the imposed 38th parallel lost nearly a third its population of 8 to 9 million people during the 37-month-long hot war, 1950 to 1953. Perhaps an unprecedented percentage of mortality suffered by one nation due to the belligerence of another. Unquote. During the Second World War, the United Kingdom lost 0.94% of its population, France lost 1.35%, China lost 1.89%, and the U.S. lost 0.32%. That was from an introduction by Professor Michel Chostodovsky posted October 30th under the headline North Korea and the Axis of Evil. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. November 7th, 2017 marks the 100th anniversary of the October Revolution, commonly referred to as the October Uprising, Red October, or the Bolshevik Revolution. The date, according to the Julian calendar Russia was following at the time, was October 25th, 1917. The Bolshevik Central Committee organized a takeover of strategic sites within the Russian capital Petrograd, or modern-day St. Petersburg, with the assistance of a flotilla of pro-Bolshevik marines entering through St. Petersburg Harbor. The provisional government surrendered without a fight to the overwhelming numbers of the revolutionaries and was overthrown. By the following day, the Second Congress of Soviets elected a Council of People's Commissars with Vladimir Lenin as leader as the basis for a new Soviet government. These developments, of course, took place in the context of a major world war and economic and social turmoil. To dissect the revolution and the crucial dynamics that played out 100 years ago, we are joined by a return guest. Dr. Jacques Pauwels is a Belgian-born Canadian historian. He's the author of the 2016 book, The Great Class War of 1914 to 1918. He joins us now to discuss some of the historical background of the revolution of October 2017 and the key events leading up to it. Dr. Pauwels, thank you once again for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, in one of our previous conversations on this program, you described how the First World War was a consequence of the elites among the great European powers needing to suppress social revolutions that were gathering steam throughout the 19th century. Maybe you could zero in on what was happening in Russia and the main factors that propelled revolution there. It was principally opposition to the war and the economic dislocation it instigated, was it not?
Yes, well, the Russia had been in trouble, so to speak. That is to say, Russia had become ripe for revolution well before the First World War. And the reason for that was that people don't make a revolution for the fun of it. People make a revolution when they're desperate and they feel that only violent change or very radical change, usually accompanied by violence, will make a difference. Will basically free them from the misery in which they find themselves. So it is a known fact that Russia, long before the war already, was a very backward country, where a small elite, the Tsar, the nobility, and the church ruled over a huge majority of very poor people who were, you know, very mostly peasants, anyways, you know, and who lived in abject poverty, and who were not happy campers. And that had already shown itself. That had led to an outburst of revolution in 1905, not surprisingly also on the occasion of another war, the war that Russia fought against Japan and lost, which made things even worse. So generally speaking, even before it came to war in 1914, it was obvious that would come to a revolutionary change in Russia sooner or later. And now what happened is that when the war breaks out, that would actually make things even worse. But the irony is that the Tsar and the elites of Russia, like the elites of Germany and Britain even, you know, expected that a war actually would chase away the specter of revolution. Because the fear of a revolution was something that was typical not only for Russia, but also for many other countries. So, for example, in Germany and even in Britain and France. And the elites believed that there was nothing like a good war to chase away that specter of revolution, that a war would be a chance to basically teach people some law and order, as we sometimes put it, and basically neutralize some of the danger that they represented in peacetime when they were getting organized, were unions, there were socialist parties, and so on. So there was a lot of fear of revolution, and the idea was that war would stop all that nonsense. But as I describe in my book, The Great Class War, and it's an irony of history that the war, which was essentially a project to chase away the idea of the revolution, actually would produce a major revolution in Russia. Yeah, so in Russia there was actually great misery before the war, which was bound to lead to revolution sooner or later. It had already done so in 1905. And then the war made the situation even worse, caused even greater misery, and therefore that led to the explosion in 1917.
Of course, I mean, especially with the deprivation of certain trade routes and the food shortages. So I guess you, essentially it was more of an amplifier for already existing conditions.
Yes, and to put it in the terms that Karl Marx described, Karl Marx had written about the inevitability of revolutionary change that would lead from capitalism to a socialist future, and he saw the key to a revolution in the pauperization of people, meaning people becoming poorer and poorer and more miserable. And that in that way the system would push people, so to speak, with their backs against the wall. So they had no choice but to hit back, to strike back, and that would be the revolution. Now, before the war, in many countries, there didn't seem to be a pauperization. In countries like France and the Low Countries and Germany and Britain, much of the working class was actually doing better. And therefore, it seemed that Marx had been wrong, that there was no pauperization. Poor people were better off and therefore less likely to become revolutionaries. But that actually changed again with the war, because the war brought back misery unseen before, greater misery than ever before. It pauperized, to use the Marxist term, it pauperized people again. And that happened most obviously in Russia, where people were poorer from the beginning. You know.
Mm. Now the run-up to the revolution, you'd look at the February Revolution, at least,
yes.
And there was a strong connection there with International Women's Day. And I'm kind of curious, because it seems to me that there's a strong, perhaps understated, the reality of so many men being sent off to war, leaving women in charge of the household. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the significance of that Women's Day event with the unrest of the war and the general revolution.
Well, I'm not an expert in Russian history, and I don't really know the details of that, but I can tell you that in general, during the war, the pauperization, the misery, was increasing rapidly, and you might say on two fronts, literally and figuratively speaking. There was, first of all, the misery that was getting bigger and bigger at the front lines among the soldiers who were killed by the millions. Russia had already lost something like 4 million men by 1917 in 3 years' time. That's more than a million a year, right? But there was also increasing misery at the home front, as it was called, where civilians were were paying a high price for the war, especially in terms of having to work longer hours for lower wages and less and less food on the table. And that's where women would come in, of course, because at the front line, that was the war itself, that was a men's affair. And in the First World War, the civilians were not involved as much, although also, but as much as they would be during the Second World War. So at the home front, it was women that actually were bearing the greatest burden of the war, and were therefore were therefore also in the forefront when it came to demanding revolutionary change, demanding radical change, demanding revolutionary change, and supporting the revolution. It is a fact that women were involved in large numbers when the demonstrations started, the riots and so on. It was not only soldiers that had come from the front, in some cases deserters. It was not only workers that were ticked off because of their longer hours and the lower wages, but women were involved big time as well. And many people think that Lenin and the Bolsheviks, had very little popular support. Many historians think it was just a conspiracy, but that is not true. The Bolsheviks had major support, and actually quite a few women joined the Bolsheviks and supported the Bolsheviks, yes. But yeah, so that's what I can say about the role of women in this whole background of war and revolution. And of course, war and revolution, they hang together. It's not a coincidence that the French Revolution actually spawned many wars, and many other revolutions in the 19th century were associated with some war, either preceded by a war or followed by a war. And again, the First World War, of course, was a big war, and it led to a big revolution. And in turn, that revolution would lead to more wars, like the Civil War in Russia. And later on, it's arguable that the Second World War was also a consequence of the First World War and the Russian Revolution.
You alluded to the front lines and the defections that were happening by the Tsar's army. What were the principal factors in their defection to the Reds?
Well, the defection, there was desertions, there was fraternizations in every army. And every army by 1916, by 1917, it was becoming pretty obvious that the soldiers had enough. They were very, very unhappy by having to do all that killing and all that dying. And many of them at first, in 1914, when the war started, had fallen for the official slogans that, you know, the other guys had to fight was the real enemy, and, you know, you should kill them because we were the good guys, they were the bad guys. And during the war, very soon, it became obvious to soldiers and all armies that actually those other guys on the other side were just as miserable as you were, and that actually the real enemy was more your own officers and generals who had caused this war, that they were the real enemy. And that became obvious, and especially with the increasing misery also at the home front, people realized that the cause they were fighting for was not their cause, that they were fighting for because their superiors had sent them into a war, but that war had nothing in it for them. So then that led to demonstrations, in some cases to you might say, refusal to fight. There were some mutinies in quite a few armies, most famously in the French army in 1917. But few people know that there was also mutinies and big trouble in the British army, for example, in that same year. But the army where there were the biggest abuses was the Russian army. That is where more soldiers were sent to their death for obviously no good reasons, where the soldiers hated the generals and the Tsar and his government who had brought on the war, who was seen responsible for it. And that's a context in which you not only have desertions, and also, by the way, killing of officers, you know, but also fraternizations with the enemy, with the quote-unquote enemy. Because many soldiers realized that the guys on the other side, you know, you didn't really want to kill them. You know, they didn't want to kill you. You should maybe join, get together, and fight our real enemies, which are our own superiors, our own officers, our own politicians, our own monarchs, tsars, and so on. And that situation became an epidemic in the Russian army already in early 1917. With tens of thousands of soldiers deserting and basically going home, you know, and going to the cities like St. Petersburg to join demonstrators, and then to join workers of the factories who were demonstrating for higher wages, for lower prices, with housewives who could feed their children. So everybody, the whole population was unhappy, had been pauperized, and therefore was in a revolutionary mood.
Yeah. I, is there anything more you could say? I mean, there's clearly strong strands of solidarity there, but can you comment any more on the efficiency of those worker solidarity actions, be they in the field, in the workplace, and the 500,000 people that demonstrated against the war and over the summer?
Well, there's actually two things that you seem to be touching on here. One is the solidarity with the so-called enemy. I mean, more and more soldiers, you know, were realizing, or rediscovering, so to speak, the idea, the basic idea of socialism, of the socialist parties of all of Europe before the war. That was a time when there was a socialist international movement, when the leaders of socialist parties, Germany, France, and so on, got together. And we're basically trying to find ways to implement Marx's idea that proletarians of the world should unite and should not fight each other in case of a war, but should instead make a common front against the common class enemy. That was the idea. And that, of course, idea then broke down in 1914 when the various socialist parties, most famously the German Social Democrats, voted for the war credits and said, okay, once more, then we'll fight for the fatherland rather than for our class. So we'll agree to fight the French, for example, even the French socialists with whom we technically have so much in common, and we promise to fight together with against class enemies. So they didn't do that. But so they did go to war against each other, and the same kind of the same message came from above in the socialist parties in France, Belgium, and you name it. But during the war, the soldiers actually realized that they had been had in 1914, that this whole idea of fighting your class, your brothers and sisters, well, your brothers in the army on the other side, was the wrong idea, and that the solution would be to join with them against the real enemy, the class enemy. Yes, that was an idea that was gaining in strength in the course of the war, and was very, very potent, again, especially in the Russian army, in 1917. And that's there was all kinds of fraternizations with the enemy at that stage. And the soldiers, the Russians and many German soldiers, refused to, you know, to continue to fight each other and kill each other, and instead actually, you know, were prepared, increasingly prepared, to basically, you know, to take up the arms against their own officers. And that's what happened in Russia.
And there was a major pushback, not just from within Russia, but also a multinational military intervention against communist Russia, joining alongside the what they called the White Russians against the Red Army.
Well, you can well imagine then when the revolution started, one of the things the revolutionaries wanted was actually not only they wanted social economic changes within the country, but perhaps the most urgent demand was for an end to this bloody war. People had enough. The soldiers had enough of the killing and the dying. They were deserting. They were showing that clearly. They were fraternizing with the enemy, so they showed that they had enough of the war. And the people at the home front had enough of the war. The women wanted bread on the table again. You know, they wanted to be able to feed their children, so everybody had enough. So pulling the country out of the war is what the revolutionaries wanted. In fact, that was the key to the success of Lenin and the Bolsheviks. Because after the initial, the first wave of the revolution in early 1917, which brought back the abdication of the Tsar in certain economic, certain social and political reforms, like universal suffrage, for example, which was pretty big deal, the provisional government, you know, of Kerensky and so on, decided to continue the war. And that is what most people, revolutionaries, did not want. And the only party that said, okay, let's get out of this war. Let's just get out of it. Let's just, that's the first thing we have to do. That was the Bolsheviks under Lenin. And that's how Lenin and the Bolsheviks got the support, without which they could not have done what they did in October then, namely come to power. They were a small group, but they had massive support because they said, we will put Russia out of the war, pull Russia out of the war. And they did. As soon as as Lenin came to power, he issued basically a peace manifesto inviting all countries, all governments to lay down the weapons and stop this terrible war. And that, of course, is why they hated him from the beginning in Paris and London and Washington, because there the idea that Russia would get out of the war was very bad militarily for them. I mean, they were counting on Russia to keep on doing its bid against the mighty German war machine, right? And that is why when the revolution, when Lenin and the Bolsheviks went ahead with their plans and made a peace treaty or signed an armistice with Germany, how then actually the Allies sent troops to Russia to help the enemies of the Bolsheviks, mostly the Tsarist party, the so-called Whites, against the Bolshevik Reds. So foreign intervention was the result of that, of Lenin and so on wanting peace. It's an odd irony of history, or rather of Western historiography, that Lenin actually did what the overwhelming majority of Russians wanted him to do, namely pull Russia out of the war. And for that, he was hated by people like Churchill, you know, who actually wanted to support the Whites, who the enemies of Lenin, who wanted to keep Russia in the war. And oddly enough, in our historiography, we describe Churchill as a wonderful Democrat and Lenin as a dictator. And yet, Lenin did exactly what the overwhelming majority of people wanted him to do. So in that respect, he was very democratic. And Churchill supported the former Tsarist elite who wanted to keep Russia in the war, which is what the people did not want. So here it's quite obvious that to say that, to claim that for example Churchill was a wonderful Democrat and Lenin was a dictator just doesn't make sense at all.
Mm-hmm. So then maybe I could just get you to comment in closing, as you event that took place 100 years ago. What's the prime lesson that you take out of those events and the way they've unrolled over the course of the 20th century?
Well, I am not an expert on Russian history. I'm an historian of the 20th century, and with actually a focus on Germany and on the wars as such. But what interests me is what the Bolshevik Revolution of 100 years ago has achieved in retrospect. And in that respect, we should say what it has achieved not only for Russia, but also for the rest of the world. Russia was very, very backward in 1914, far more backward, for example, than Britain or France or many other countries in Europe. And then the war caused enormous destruction in Russia. I just mentioned like millions of men lost, not only in the war, but then later on in the civil war that followed the revolution. So the country was actually totally on the ground in the early 1920s. And yet, by 1950, in fact, by 1945, the Soviet Union, the successor state of the Tsarist Russia, was the second most powerful country in the world. And that is an amazing achievement if you think about it. The October Revolution made Russia, made the Soviet Union first, and then later on today's Russia, a major, major power, which and Russia still is today. And it brought most Russians a much greater standard of living. Many people whose grandparents were very poor peasants, you know, became engineers, became doctors, lawyers, you know, and by the 50s. So there was enormous social progress. Then there's one more way in which we can say that the Soviet Union, you know, has made a tremendous contribution in the positive sense, and that is by its support for people in what is now the Third World. It was the example of the October Revolution that inspired people like Mao Zedong in China and for Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. And if Vietnam, for example, could become independent, it certainly wasn't easy. It was mainly because of people like Ho Chi Minh and the inspiration they had found in the October Revolution. And the same can be said about Mao Zedong. I mean, today, I was just in China a couple of months ago, China has lifted millions of people out of poverty. And that's become possible because of the revolution that was started by Mao, was inspired by the October Revolution. And here I should say one more thing, which most people in the Western world don't realize. That is that in a way we too owe a lot of we in the Western world owe a lot to the October Revolution, because it was the fear that a revolution like the one in Russia in 1917 might also happen in countries like France, Britain, Belgium, and so on. At the end of the war, where people had also been pauperized, were also ticked off, and were also in a very evil mood and ready to make a revolution. That it was the fear of that that caused the elites to introduce democratic changes, such as there was a wave of democratic changes in all of Western Europe in 1918, 1919, with, for example, introduction of universal suffrage, with a 8-hour day, and all kinds of concessions, you know, basically to take the revolutionary wind out of the sails of people. And the same thing happened after the Second World War. So in many ways, if Western Europe and if Canada had achieved a high degree of social as well as political democracy, first after the First World War and secondly after the Second World War, it was in many ways because of the influence of the revolution, because of the fear of revolution.
Dr. Powles, it's been a pleasure having you on the show again. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.
Well, you're welcome.
We've been joined by Dr. Jack Powles. He is a Canadian historian and author of the 2016 book, The Great Class War of 1914 to 1918. You can find several of his articles archived on the site globalresearch.ca.
This program is a joint effort between independent media site globalresearch.ca and CKUW 95.9 FM, a community radio station based in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabeg and Niyawak peoples and the homeland of the Red River Métis. Independent media has been under assault over the past year, with initiatives to curb the dissemination of what's being called fake news. With certain inconvenient facts being suppressed through algorithms on social media like Facebook and Google search engines, it is all the more urgent that readers and listeners continue to donate to the alternative news and views they've come to depend on. Please consider donating to globalresearch.ca by visiting the site globalresearch.ca and clicking donate on the menu bar. Please also consider contributing to community radio stations like CKUW 95.9 FM, which hosts the Global Research News Hour. Every dollar we receive is appreciated. Thanks to our listeners who continue to support the independent alternative.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
An exploration of the legacy of the Russian Revolution must by necessity include a discussion of the pushback against it, and principally by the major capitalist powers, especially the United States. Joining us to delve further into that topic, we're privileged to be joined by Professor Michel Chosadovsky. He is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and he is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa and the award-winning author of 11 books, including America's War on Terrorism from 2005, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War from 2011, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity from 2015. He joins us now from Montreal. Good afternoon, Professor Chosadovsky.
Good afternoon. Delighted to be on the program.
Now, I imagine the pushback against communist Russia started with the Russian Civil War in terms of the involvement of the U.S., France, and Britain, and Japan. To what extent was this an assault on the ideology of communism versus a reopening of the Eastern Front against Germany?
Well, it's a very complex history, but I think what we must understand that the moment that Russia signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which was in March 3 of 1918, the Western powers intervened on the side of the Russian imperial, what was left of the Russian imperial white army, so to speak. In fact, they even intervened at an earlier period. But what struck me there, because I had analyzed Chinese history, that this was a multinational endeavor. It included quite a number of countries, and it seemed to be very much a replicate of the multinational force which acted to restore colonial power in China following the so-called Boxer's Rebellion of 1900, where a multinational force was set loose in China, and which ultimately restored the treaty ports and so on. I think the logic is that the West intervenes, and ultimately this military intervention, which was of several countries, with France and Britain taking the lead, and that was prior to the end of World War I, and it was against Russia, it wasn't against Germany, was really there to thwart the regime change which had taken place against Imperial Tsarist Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just, when we move further through history, as that evolved, it seems to me that, there was developed a Cold War after World War II, but, that time, leading up to World War II, I know that when I talked to Jacques Powells, a couple of years ago, he mentioned that essentially World War II was a war between the U.S. and British powers attempting to use Hitler against the Soviet Union as an instrument. I'm wondering if you could comment on that particular turning point and how things changed after the war.
Well, I mean, essentially, if you look back in history, the Cold War started in 1917. It it went through different phases, but essentially, there was always an intent on the part of Western capitalism to undermine the Soviet project right from the beginning, right from day one, or maybe right from October. But there was the February Revolution and then the October Revolution. And then you had, of course, the Western intervention in the Civil War. Now, what struck me, and I'm fast forward to World War II, is that when the United States developed the Manhattan Project, namely the development of nuclear weapons, and the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima on the 6th of August, 1945, was the nuclear weapon intended to be used against Japan, or was it in fact intended right from the outset to be used against the Soviet Union. And in other words, to destroy, to erase the Soviet Union from the map, so to speak. Now, I say this because while we know about the fact that nuclear weapons were deployed during the Cold War against the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and China, okay, and we've got declassified documents to support that, what is not really known to public opinion, although the documents are there, is that in September 1945, the United States has already made a list of major urban areas to be targeted using atom bombs. And they, in fact, it was some 204 atom bombs, and they categorized it by city: Moscow 6, Leningrad 6, Tashkent 6, and so on, and smaller cities, one or two. But I think what is important in that particular, in those also declassified documents but less known, is the fact that the war, the nuclear war against the Soviet Union, was on the drawing board at a much earlier period. And it was also part of the Manhattan Project. It was not to be used necessarily against Nazi Germany or Japan. It was intended to be used against the Soviet Union. And, you know, the documents drawn up by the United States were at a time when the Soviet Union and the United States were allies. They were allies until 1947. Officially, the Cold War started in 1947. But 2 years before that, there were plans to blow up the Soviet Union, which then led to the fact that the Soviet Union developed the nuclear bomb in 1949 and used it as a deterrent. Now, those plans had not been drawn up in 1945, the world would be a very different place today, because we wouldn't have had any response from the Soviet Union or from China. China also developed the nuclear capabilities, and they were materialized in the early 60s in response to U.S. plans to use nuclear weapons against China as of 1950, a few months after the inauguration of the People's Republic of China on October 1, 1949. Yes, that's right, October 1, 1949.
I mean, there's that period of decolonization, then Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Vietnam War, Afghanistan. How did the Soviet Union weather those developments economically and politically?
Well, let me put it somewhat differently. The Truman Doctrine, which was formulated by George Kennan, the State Department, in the mid to late 40s, that is what set the stage of the Cold War. But in effect, if we look at the period from, let's say, 1945 to 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, you had a buildup. Well, you had a buildup of nuclear capabilities on the part of the United States, which were then followed by nuclear capabilities by Russia, which developed its nuclear bomb in 1949, and then, of course, China. But the thing is that it was an extremely, from the point of view of U.S. military doctrine, was really based on the notion of a first strike, that they could actually liquidate the Soviet Union. And then you had, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was, in effect, resolved. And I think it was resolved because you had a progressive president in the United States of America at the time, John F. Kennedy, who was later assassinated. And you had McNamara, who was on the whole relatively very much aware of the dangers of the nuclear doctrine, which had been formulated back in the 1940s. What happened is that there was communication between Nikolai Sergeyevich Khrushchev, the Russian leader, on the one hand, and Kennedy. They consulted, they spoke on the phone, and they were not there to mislead one another, because they understood that despite their differences, this Cuban Missile Crisis had to be resolved in some way. Now, if we compare to the situation today, we have a situation of nuclear threats against Iran and North Korea, but we also have nuclear threats against China and Russia, and we have a $1 trillion nuclear weapons program, which was launched during the Obama administration. We're in a very different situation today to the Cuban Missile Crisis, largely because there are two reasons. One, the technologies have evolved dramatically, the war technologies and nuclear technologies. But two, we don't have the leaders in the United States of America which are in any way comparable to what we had in the 60s with John F. Kennedy. And there's no lines of communication between, let's say, the Kremlin and the White House, or between the White House and the leaders in North Korea, which would enable us to defuse this crisis. There's no desire for peace negotiations with North Korea, for instance. And now there's a new thrust of U.S. foreign policy against Iran, and so on and so forth. So what I should mention, although it's somewhat maybe indirectly related to the October Revolution, is that we've reached a very serious crossroads in our history, perhaps the most dangerous crossroads in our history. But in effect, there's a whole historical process behind that. And it's the fact, ultimately, that the United States of America has an imperial agenda and will not accept any deviations by sovereign countries, whether they have a socialist agenda or whether they have an alternative capitalist agenda, as in, let's say, Russia today, and of course also China, which is a de facto capitalist country.
I just want to try to maybe just sort of wrap up a little bit in the sense that I'm wondering if there's this perception out there that they had the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution, and ultimately it failed. But I'm wondering if there's anything that can be retained from that revolution that's persisted today. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think what has happened throughout the 20th century has been the emergence of a numerous anti-imperialist struggles, some of which are reformist, others are socialist nature, etc. And if we look back in history, China, Indonesia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Chile, Cuba, of course, Tanzania, Algeria. Numerous countries around the world had a socialist project, a reformist project, and most of those processes in the post-Cold War era have literally been wiped out. with a couple of exceptions, Cuba perhaps, North Korea. I think that has to be emphasized because the Soviet Union was a countervailing power, which also enabled other countries to detach themselves from Western colonialism, so to speak.
Okay. Well, Professor Michel Chosudovsky, I wish we had more time, but we appreciate this overview of the last century since the October Revolution. I hope we can discuss this and related events in the future. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Delighted.
We've been speaking with Michel Chosudovsky, award-winning author, emeritus professor of economics, and director and founder of the Center for Research on Globalization. He spoke to us from Montreal.
Kees van der Pyl is a professor emeritus of international relations at the University of Sussex and former director of the Center for Global Political Economy. He's currently active with the Dutch anti-fascist resistance, having served as its president. He's the author of a paper, From Permanent Revolution to Permanent Counter-Revolution, which served as the theme of his keynote lecture at a conference sponsored by the University of Manitoba's Geopolitical Economy Research Group. Van der Pyl evokes the notion of a permanent revolution, a term coined by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, but more closely associated with Leon Trotsky. He claims that to understand the failure of movements over the last century to move beyond democratic revolution to socialism, one must also postulate the reality of a permanent counter-revolution. As van der Pyl sees it, at the core of the counter-revolution is the liberal middle classes, or bourgeoisie, initially aligned with the working classes against the landed classes, seeking to advance the education level of society and other productive forces in society, while denying the more radical demands of the working class. He sees the democratic revolutions which spread across Europe in the mid-19th century as the origin of this conception of permanent counter-revolution. Kees van der Pyl.
1848 was a revolution across Europe, which was actually, the intention of that was to crush the forces of restoration that had been established after the fall of Napoleon. And Marx made the famous, from Marx we have the famous quote in which he says the revolution of 1848 shouldn't be judged by its own tragicomical accomplishments, but by the powerful counter-revolution it provoked. And I would say that is really the beginning of what I call permanent counter-revolution. And why is that? Because at that moment there's a rift between the bourgeois goals, and bourgeois goals mean establishing a unified national state, having one currency, education for people, etc., and of course beginning capitalist development, and the goals of the labor movement, which was rights for the working man and so on. The bourgeoisie takes its, let's say, entrepreneurship, its ability to shape a new mental world, to produce a particular literature, both fictional and non-fiction, so to speak, to create a certain academic environment, to bring all the aspects of the modern age that we are used to now, but which it no longer puts at the surface of a general liberation, a general democratic process, but at a more specific process. And that process I would now call, now that I reflect on it again, progressive counter-revolution. The fact that the bourgeoisie goes over to a different position from the joint revolutionary position with the large mass of the population to a special role makes give you this oddly sounding complex of a progressive counter-revolution. That is, they still want to develop what Marx calls the productive forces, which means the education level of society, the ability of people to cooperate, so to get modern industry and all the services around it that are necessary. And but at the same time, it wants to prevent any autonomous project of the working class. And another quote of Marx that I also mentioned in my talk was that he says, England is the rock on which the counter-revolution will build its church. And I think it's very important to see the choice for England, because England at the time was the most advanced capitalist country. It supported the counter-revolution on the one hand by paying and subsidizing and supporting everything that was reactionary, simply to crush national movements, progressive movements, whatever. But on the other hand, it was still in a position to spread the capitalism. I would say from 1848 till today, and the breaking point there is 2008, the large financial crisis, and basically, yeah, the end of capitalism, if you ask me. But would that make it take another 30 years of global misery to fully pan out? But at that point, the progressive aspect of the counter-revolution loses steam, because capitalism is no longer able to develop the productive forces. It cannot really bring general welfare, or even welfare to, let's say, the broad middle classes. It can now only, it also cannot do the things that we associate with a generalization of national education, a spread of a national media. That bond of mutual trust has broken down, and that is not just a psychological process. That has to do something with the inability of capitalism to advance a more or less general welfare. Of course, it was always limited, just as the human face of capitalism was limited geographically to the West. But paradoxically, we now enter an era in which revolution is actually becoming a real possibility again, for the simple reason that people at some point, and of course we're still floating on waves of wealth that date from the earlier period. You know, people still have, in Western Europe, in North America, large parts of society still have considerable wealth, in the, but they also have even larger debts. And that debt mountain is bound to explode again, just as it exploded in 2008.
Looking at the utilizing the Russian Revolution as a case study, some of the characteristics of the counter-revolutionary struggle there, and what that how that speaks to the current climate.
The moment you focus on an event like the Russian Revolution, you tend to lose sight of the counter-revolutionary effect, also because the counter-revolution in key respects was defeated in the way it manifested itself, let us say, as an anti-revolutionary movement. So right after 1917, of course, there was an uprising of remnants of the Tsarist empires and bourgeois and landowning elements with their own serfs and so on. And of course, cruelty on both sides gives the self-perpetuating dynamic to the conflict, and the West supported that. The West intervened. I think, if I'm not mistaken, 14 countries sent troops from Czechoslovakia to the United States, to France and Britain, etc., Japan even. And yet, in the Civil War, the Bolsheviks triumphed. But that triumph is a triumph that is mortgaged by the simultaneous retreat, you know, that you have to make by reducing democracy in your own ranks, by reintroducing a military discipline, unwillingness to accept dissent, impossibility to accept dissent, because in a situation where you are in the weaker global balance, dissent inevitably becomes the voice of the stronger imperialist party. You know, however sincere the motives may be of the revolutionary current that says we should do things differently, it's not just a matter of conspiratorial blackballing of dissent. It's obvious you are objectively doing the work for the outside forces. That, of course, that leads to immense tragedies, because the people who spoke up for democracy in, let's say, 1928, 29, and in the 1930s, well, basically were dead, but because the Soviet Union then already was entrenching against the danger of the second wave of counter-revolutionary attack on them, and that was Nazism and fascism. Basically, you might say that because, as you just mentioned, the radical program was backtracked in the revolutionary process, it created marginal groups which broke away from the willingness of, let's say, social democracy or the mainstream communist party to negotiate with the bourgeoisie or even strike a compromise with it. And among these fragments on the far left, plus the fragments on the far right, were groups that could be manipulated into violence. And I think that you can say that, especially after the events in Italy in the 1970s, the so-called strategy of tension, you know, with bomb attacks left and right, from that moment on, the dominant, although the other forms also remain operational, but the dominant form becomes what I call a centrist coup. That is a coup that doesn't look at a coup as a coup at all, but that looks as an attempt to restore normalcy to the situation. People will always be happy with that, against extremist violence. But you see it also in the violence of the so-called jihadists, you know, that today in the war on terror. We're all against terror, of course. We are encouraged to think about the perpetrators of these acts as evil incarnate. And you will therefore always have a majority supporting you in clamping down very seriously on these groups. Now, I would say that is a contemporary form of permanent counter-revolution. Not because I say that these groups are counter-revolutionary or revolutionary, but because the imposition of discipline on society, all these things make clear that we are under constant surveillance, that constantly society is being watched from all sides, and that a security veil has been imposed on it, all under with the one official reason is the fight against terror. Although, you know, the actual number of people who are being killed by terror attacks, however gruesome in some cases, is negligible compared to the monthly count, for instance, of the dead in Iraq. Why these individual events happen is secondary to the much more important fact that it is used to create a national security culture in which, in the repressive atmosphere that you get, every form of dissent becomes suspect of links to more violent forms of changing the existing order. And that is, I think, the stage of counter-revolution that we are now in, which is no longer progressive counter-revolution, but it's slipping into open neo-fascist or proto-fascist forms of repression.
That was Kees van der Peil, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at the University of Sussex and former director of the Center for Global Political Economy, speaking to the Global Research NewsHour in early October 2017. You've been listening to the Global Research NewsHour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.